Min campus al ihor. Miaj Karsten Schwine. Għakom għal-program iħor laxar biħed fit-tieni sensiela ta' Min Campus għal iħor fuq Campus FM. Nirringrazzjakom li hemm ta' respons ta'kom wara programmi vari fej tun anki idejat ġieli ta' ma' min nistgħu nitkellmu jew anki suġġetti fejn niftħu u nimilħu f'dan il-kollegament li qed nippruvaw nagħmlu bej il-campus ta' Malta, ta' Università ta' Malta, kemm l-aktar Ewropa, kemm l-aktar belt fil-verità, kif ukoll kollegi, professjonisti, letturi anki riċerkaturi, kif ukoll studenti illi huma mfexxa madwar id-dinja ħafna drabi Maltin stess jew li jkunu kkollaboraw mal-Università ta' Malta, kif ukoll oħrajn illi forsi jkunu missu ma' Malta, forsi le, imma hemm numru mill-mistidrin ta' dawn is-sensijiet illi fil-fatt ikunu b'xi mod jikkollaboraw ma' entitajiet, organizzazzjonijiet u sħab Maltin ukoll. Fil-programm tal-lum ħa nisimgħu intervista ma' Professor David Stevenson illi huwa bbażat l-Università ta' Queen Margaret University ġewwa Edinburgh l-Iskozja. Fil-każ tiegħu huwa bbażat hemmhekk, kellu karriera kif ħajdilna diversa, varjata, mhux wieħed minn dawk illi isum il-bidu kien jaf illi ħa jkollu karriera akademika u bis-saħħa hekk fil-fatt irnexxielu jiżviluppa ħsieb u jintegra skola ta' ħsieb interessanti ħafna fil-qasam tal-politika kulturali u tal-management illi għarrep kemm id-dinja privata kif ukoll dik pubblika. Hemm għandu però rabta ma' Malta għaliex ġieli kollabora ma' entitajiet Maltin fosthom il-Kunsill Malti għall-Arti u kif ħa nisimgħu wkoll ġieli jkun hemm ukoll riċerkaturi u studenti Maltin illi jistudjaw ġewwa l-Università ta' Queen Margaret University f'dan il-qasam. Jikkollaboraw miegħu jew bħala parti mill-istudji tagħhom jew anki bħala proġetti. David Stevenson huwa din tal-iskola tal-arti tal-management u tal-istudji xjentifiċi ġewwa Queen Margaret University. Il-dottorat tiegħu kienet jiffoka fuq il-kultura u modi ta' kollaborazzjoni ta' management, ta' investimenti illi jġibu ma' xulxin elementi differenti tal-prattika tal-kultura. Mhux dejjem forsi dik illi tibda minn ġewwa istituzzjoni, imma anki elementi oħrajn illi l-ġieli jistgħu forsi ifixklu u jħarsu minn angli differenti li l-kollaborazzjoni. Kellna mistieden ieħor fil-fatt li nissensiela Anthony Shrag illi ukoll huwa fl-istess dipartiment u b'xi mod forsi wieħed li jsemma dak il-programm jista' jassoċja ftit il-skola tal-ħsieb illi qiegħda tiġi żviluppata minn ġewwa dan id-dipartiment bħalissa. Huwa fellow tal-Higher Education Academy u Royal Society of Arts u huwa wkoll fuq il-board editoriali ta' Cultural Trends illi għal min forsi jsegwu ftit dan is-settur huwa wieħed mill-prem journals f'dan il-qasam. Huwa wkoll involut ħafna ma' Central St. Martin's Londra u dan ukoll huwa interessanti għaliex hemm numru ta' nies kreattivi Malta illi fil-fatt studjaw jew għadhom ukoll jikkollaboraw ma' Central St. Martin's Londra u wkoll ma' Aberdeen University. Huma interessanti wkoll għax anke xi nies Maltin hemmhekk ifittxu illi immexxu l-istudji tagħhom u jimxu l-qudiem fil-karriri tagħhom. Ippubblika ħafna, kiteb ħafna, immexxi ħafna proġetti anki fondi internazzjonali u din l-intervista tiegħu hija pjuttost interessanti għaliex kif dejjem nagħmlu nippruvaw ndaħlu anki elementi u aneddoti personali kif ukoll l-għażla mużikali tal-mistennin tagħna. Mela ejja nisimgħu hemm l-intervista ma' David Stevenson fil-waqt li nerġgħu ngħaddu għall-intervista bejn bil-mużika ta' Medinea u dejjem nirringrazzjahom tal-li jipprovdu din il-mużika għal dan il-programm. After that introduction, and Maltese, as usual, that I carry out on the program Min Campus Alihor, I'm back with my guest, not physically because we're not in the same room, but connecting Edinburgh, the campus at Queen Margaret University, with the one at the University of Malta. So my guest is David Stevenson. Hi, David.
Hello, Carson. How are you?
I'm good. Just before we started this program, we're recording at the end of October. And I was telling you how heavy rainfall struck Malta and Sicily and this part of the Mediterranean because you were hoping maybe for some rays of sunshine to be sent across to Edinburgh, but we're not in that position. But you're far worse, I guess. From what you said.
Yes, it's having been to Malta a number of times and having experienced the glorious climate, although I did also encounter a Maltese rainstorm, which was simultaneously one of the heaviest rainstorms I've been in, but also one of the shortest rainstorms I've ever been in as well. So I know that sunlight is very well available, and it would be nice right now because yes, it has been pouring for the last 24 hours here. So we share that in common today.
Yes, that's right. With our listeners, we'll also share a few other things, I'm sure, because as our listeners now in the second series, we're already on program 10 of the second series, guests on the show sort of have many things in common amongst themselves, but also with listeners who are maybe students, maybe academics, maybe also the members of the general public, but somehow interested in knowing a little bit more about the research of people from Europe, but all around the world, really, coming and connecting from different campuses. After all, that's what the program is called, Min Campus Alihor, sort of campus hopping or campus connecting campuses, so to speak. And also, however, also the personal story, so how the professional and the personal are together, because after all, it's also very different between different people, even the way they narrate their stories. Some might be a bit more direct, to the point, narrating their professional development. Others might sort of bring in more anecdotes and stories. And we've met a few times in Malta and Valletta, but also in Edinburgh on discussions of various things, let's say related to cultural policy, because you'll be going into that a bit more in depth. But there's a lot of this as well in your story, as far as I know it, and as far as also you've told it to me when we prepared for this program. And I think that can be very, on the one hand, consoling for especially the younger maybe listeners who realize or maybe have the feeling that life can be a little bit of a zigzag and up and down and not a straight line. On the other hand, also inspiring, however. And in fact, connecting to people who have worked or are related to the Maltese campus or students or Maltese cultural policy practitioners. There have been a few, Tony Attar, Adrian De Battista, who have been also on other programs here on Campus FM, who somehow keep linking these two campuses. So let me stop here myself, David, and sort of over to you, in the sense of that maybe if we could somehow start off from early phases, and somehow take us through this voyage, which is, yeah, so very much practice-based and linked to the private sector, and sometimes not at all oriented in an academic way, but somehow then linking into this dimension. In a way, where did it all start?
Absolutely. I mean, and I think I really sort of empathize with that story that you were talking there around about kind of having something that was non-linear or kind of non-expected. And for anyone listening who is younger or younger than I am, potentially coming to the end of high school, and looking to think about where to go next, I guess what I would say is that opportunities arise and some of those opportunities work and some of them might not work. And they might not work then for you, but that's not to say that things are not going to work again in the future. So kind of thinking around about my own background, my own career and how I've ended up here, when I was at school, I was what might be understood as an academic student. I did well at school. I got used to getting grades that were good grades. And so everybody was very, very pleased about that. And there was a sense that I would go to university, that I would enjoy university, I would do well at university. That was going to be the obvious outcome. And I was particularly passionate about a range of different things. I was as interested in science and maths as I was interested in English literature and in drama. But I was especially kind of influenced by a drama teacher that I had that had shown me the potential to go and study drama, and that was an option and that I could go to a university and explore this further. And influenced by that individual and also influenced, I guess, by their own journey to becoming a drama teacher. They introduced me to a university in Wales. Obviously, I'm from Scotland. And one of the things I was quite keen to do was to have an adventure. And I think that wherever you are from, whether that's Malta, whether that's Edinburgh, whether that's, you know, New York City, when you are at school, there is a sense of wanting to see what else there is and looking to go somewhere else, somewhere different.
Yes. Somehow the virtual travels start egging you on to move actually physically.
Yeah, just that sense of what else is there and what else can you do. And I think nowadays that for young people thinking about this at school, I can only imagine that it's even more present because the internet, and I was just actually talking to somebody about the fact that I think my generation is the last generation for whom I grew up in a pre-internet world, and the internet was just starting to kind of materialize towards the end of my high school journey. So I got into university, and I went to university in Wales. I remember my mum driving me to Wales. I hadn't realized quite how far away Wales was from where I lived. And I was 17 because where my birthday lies, I was a relatively young, I was a relatively young graduate from high school. Yes. I was right at the end of that kind of year group. And so here I was, I found myself, I was 17. I was at university in Wales, in Aberystwyth. Aberystwyth is a very small town, a sort of beach resort or a Victorian beach resort that was very kind of popular at a different era. And other than Aberystwyth, you're quite far away from anywhere else. I mean, Cardiff, which is the nearest big city, is a good couple of hours away, as is Bristol.
You remind me of when I visited my cousins related to my mother's side.
Okay.
It was of a bit of a similar, more recent and less distant, but only from Warwick. because of the trains. It was November, I remember. So it was like going to the end of the land, sort of.
Yes. Yeah. No, there's a real sense of, and parts of Scotland have that as well. But I hadn't, at 17 years old, I don't think I'd realised that Wales was the same. That you're sitting on a train and you think, wait a minute, everything's finished, you know, it's all gone and we're going to pop out at the end. So here I was, I found myself 17 years old at university studying drama and English literature. And on one hand, you know, it was really exciting. But on the other hand, it was so very different. It was different from being at school. It was different being away from home. I had also kind of settled in my head that I was gay, and I was meeting people for the first time and introducing myself in that way. And the almost overstimulus, I guess, of everything that was going on. So new country, new place, new way of working, new way of
introducing
yourself.
In a way, even presenting yourself in this new way, as you said, with many discoveries happening concurrently. But not doing so only at home, maybe in a way better because of one sort of comes across as a new set of identities in a new context. But it's so challenging.
Yeah, I mean, and you're quite right. And that sense of who you were, and then now who are you? And I think one of the other things, and I see it a lot in students now. Is that first, and I remember getting my first assessments back, and I spent time on them, and I put the same amount of effort into them that I'd put into my assignments at high school. And I remember getting back a B grade. And again, this challenges your sense of who you are, because you've sort of got that thing, you've had it taught to you from the outset that says, you know, you're an A grade student. This is the way that you work. You're definitely up at this space. And so that sense of identity that you were talking about is changing in all sorts of ways, positive, challenging ways coming into this discussion. And actually, I very much remember the phone call. I remember, and at the time, for listeners, there was a world before mobile phones. And I remember walking down to the phone box that we had to use. I was on kind of halls of residence, and there was a little phone box at the end. And I remember phoning my mum, and asking mum rather tearfully that I wanted to come home. And again, for listeners that perhaps, you know, have never encountered a pre-mobile phone era, you also had to feed these phones, obviously, with money, which meant that if you didn't have enough money, the phone cut off. So if you were having emotional conversations, those emotional conversations were relatively time limited, depending upon how much change you had to put in the machine. So yes,
it's such a physical as well dimension.
Yes.
That now with mobile phones and internet, we don't really have anymore. But literally, putting of coins down the machine.
Yeah. And also, I remember, you know, standing
in a public place.
It was in the stairwell, and you're having this emotional conversation in a stairwell, and you just think about that now. And you go, gosh, that, you know, I think there was people walking past. I was probably crying at the time. And anyway, so I decided that I wasn't going to continue. And I decided that I would leave, and that it wasn't working out, or it wasn't working out for me. And I think part to your point that you just said, I think part of that was that I had to think about who I was. Not working out for me, I think I'd lost a sense of who me was. I'd lost a sense of who I was. Not in a bad way, but just actually that sense had been challenged, and I needed a bit of time and a bit of space to allow that to settle.
Who you had been up till then, so to speak.
And I think it has informed, and I was having a conversation with a colleague at another university last year, and I remember them being quite surprised about this. And I think it's always fascinating for me when you reflect on these things, how these experiences shape your academic work, even the kind of the methodological approach that you will have. Because we're talking about a sense of authenticity.
Yeah.
And they were talking about what it means to be authentic to yourself.
For yourself, okay.
And I brought the sense that I was like, well, I don't actually think I have a concrete self, the sense of the I, the sense of an identity that says...
The core identity. Sometimes there are members of Gestalt psychologists talking about, at the end of the day, you're not like an onion, but you're like a peach, and there's something at the core.
And I really know I'm no longer wedded to a sense that this is who I am, you know, that David Stevenson is this person, he does these things, he likes this stuff, he responds in these ways. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are patterns, and of course, there are habits, and there are rituals, but, and I think tracking it back to that event where actually what happened was I had a very concrete sense of an I, and that concrete sense of I came up against a changing context, and I found it very difficult to reconcile the two.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe intuitively or through kind of reflection at the time, I realized that the I is going to change, the identity is going to change throughout life in different ways. And I really think that has been something that stood me in good stead, is the ability to say, maybe I can be different, maybe I can change. And I think that's a really good academic trait as well, because it allows you to be open to being wrong and to understanding other people's experiences.
I think, David, we'll stop a little bit to reflect a bit on what you said. Also because, on the one hand, you're making me think of planets and how sort of it's maybe more of a nebulous characterization of who we are. Where maybe the clouds at the core then become dense. But there isn't of this hard pit at the core, which is unchanging and unchangeable. On the other hand, however, you're making me think of the first song we'll be listening in a second, because again, related to sort of a very atmospheric type of environment, and the song I really like myself. And also then, however, probably, because when we come back after the break, we'll start looking at a little bit of the research, but also the next steps you took in order to sort of lead yourself to the current research, which, as I said at the beginning, also touches upon this idea of failure as not something which is an end in itself, but that's something which is very important in the process. But first things first, let's start with the first track then that you chose for us today.
So my first track that I chose was Night Swimming by REM. And I think the reason that I picked this and what we've just been talking about there is that my relationship with music is, some people say it's quite interesting. They say that I'm quite fickle. I think some people always have favorite albums that, you know, there's favorite artists that they're really driven by a particularly kind of aesthetic drive for certain types of music. For me, music is incredibly evocative of times in my life and of people. And if I was to create a sort of a playlist at the end of my life, that playlist would probably be really eclectic. And it would be eclectic because it would be picking songs out that absolutely take me back to a moment in history or take me back to a particular person. And this song, and the reason that I've chosen it, is because it absolutely speaks to that time that I was just talking about when I was 17, when I'd gone to university for the first time. And it is a song that is evocative. It is a song that is immersive. It is a song that, for me, is full of emotion without necessarily having to even listen to or even understand the lyrics. And I think that's that very romantic notion that music, above all cultural forms, has a capacity to connect to those emotional memories and emotional moments in a way that no other cultural form can have. So every time I listen to this, I am 17 again. I am sitting in my halls of residence eating crunchy nut cornflakes from a bowl, and wondering how I got here.
So let's go through this vicariously with you again.
Night swimming deserves a quiet night. Oh, photograph on the dashboard, taken years ago. Turned around back so the windshield shows every street light, reveals a picture in reverse. Still it's so much clearer, I forgot my shirt at water's edge. The moon is low tonight. Night swimming deserves a quiet night. I'm not sure all these people understand. Not like years ago, fear of getting caught, the recklessness of water, they cannot see me naked.
Okay, so I won't add too much after having listened to REM. I think you really put it well, it's evocative. And I think for many of our listeners, not everyone, there'll be these extensions of memory and of emotions, which is something beautiful in music, the same tune, which might lead to so many people in different directions. And I remember in preparing for this program, you had mentioned to me sort of the importance of music and film. I remember it. So you said, do I just have to pick films and books? I said, no, let's stick to music. But you did mention this thing of how sometimes the mood, is more important maybe than the lyrics, or maybe precisely what place. But if we go back a little bit to where we left off, so the experience with school, with academia, I think something here is very interesting for you, but even for our listeners, because somehow you shifted back away and then back in.
Yeah.
Into sort of the world of let's say work, away a little bit away from academia, but then somehow how you sort of kept weaving yourself through those. Could you take us a little bit through what happened next?
Yeah, so I decided that I wanted to do, and I think there was a real sense of having been on this journey and having been on kind of train tracks that said, this is what you do next. And all of a sudden I came up against this wall, things changed, but that was so liberating because once you've made that jump, once I was out of that very kind of strict, rigid structure and all of the people that I'd gone to school with, I was going to be, if I went back to university, I was going to be a year behind them anyway. And it opened a whole world of possibilities to me. And when I'd left university, I'd got a part-time job because I needed something to do. And I was really excited about having money, about the capacity to, you know, use that money. But I was also, because I was somebody who was comfortable with learning, I was reading, you know, I was reading different subjects. I was looking at different areas. It wasn't structured learning. But I just got a sense that I was like, why do I need to choose between these two things? I both of them excite me. I like the connection between the two. I enjoyed the validation of being good at work. And there were opportunities to go for promotion and to be supported and to be trained. And so, yeah, I ended up working in retailing, and I worked in retailing for the same organization for almost 10 years. I went through various training development programs. I was put on management training programs, and they were incredibly valuable to me. And I got a real broad skill set that taught me about finance and about risk management and about human resources management and around about budgeting. And it was exciting because I was learning. I was learning about things that I didn't necessarily expect or know that I wanted to learn about. And I could see the impact of what I was doing. Retailing is a very easy impact because you see it through sales, you see it through people engaging. So there's a real immediate response to that. But alongside that, I was continuing to sort of engage on voluntary basis within the arts sector, within the museum sector. So it was always there. It was always ticking along in the background. So I did a number of different jobs. I worked for the same organization for quite a significant amount of time. I got promoted, and then I eventually left the organization to go to a different retailing organization. And again, I got to that point where I was forced to make a choice to say, do I stay on this path? Because I was aware that I was very clearly getting into the next job. And I was like, I'm going to end up being, you know, country manager or country director. Is that where I want to go? And I wasn't sure. And then I thought, actually, I want to probably get that degree that I never got. And so I then decided that I would do a degree with the Open University. And so I started a degree in art history with the Open University. But of course, the glory of that and the reason I did that is because I didn't want to stop working. And so
because just very briefly, maybe listeners of a certain age and also maybe being familiar with the UK structure and system would know how the Open University works. But maybe very briefly. Could you just say stuff what the benefits were, particularly at that point in time? For someone who, just very briefly again, when you mentioned the things of, did you have always to choose? And sometimes maybe you felt you could do both. It reminded me of that extract scene from the book and the film of the talented Mr. Ripley, where sort of this, there's this challenge going on. I remember the Jude Law character in the film, where so he's being challenged whether he needs to choose between the drums and the trumpet.
That's right.
And he says, look, why can't I do both?
Yes.
And you remind me a bit of this, and possibly, coming back to my question, sort of how the Open University allowed that, and then I'll let you take us to the next step.
I do love The Talented Mr. Ripley, so I do love the comparison, although I'm hoping you're not suggesting that the next thing I did was smack someone around the head with an oar and a bolt.
Absolutely not.
But the Open University, to a certain extent, was kind of ahead of its time. So the Open University is a distance learning university in the UK, and so what it offered was the opportunity to do degrees without having to go to a specific location. And at the point that I did the degree, again, the internet was obviously available, but basically what happened is that every 3 months, potentially, you would start a new module and you would get a very exciting delivery at your front door. And that delivery in the box would have textbooks and it would have assessments and it would have everything that you were going to be doing. And essentially what you did was you would teach yourself through watching recorded content that was available via DVD. You would read the textbooks. And there were also residential learning weeks that you got to go to. Mm-hmm. So once a year, you would have a sort of residential learning week where you kind of came together to meet with people.
While you say that, I'm sure our listeners are thinking about something you guys do, which is sort of, it sounds oddly familiar, especially over what happened in the last couple of years.
I mean, absolutely. And I adored it. I loved it. It was the university experience that I'd been looking for originally, which didn't ask me to do one or the other thing. I could put it together. I could work when I wanted to work. If I got really excited about a subject, then I could spend the whole week kind of looking at the subject and just getting really immersed with it. And also I wasn't someone who necessarily needed a lot of social learning support. And I think that is the downside of that approach. But I was always convinced that it was a very good and effective way to learn. And I've carried that forward. And actually, yes, in terms of blended learning, the way you've been working, it is a similar type of model that is there. So it allowed me to combine working part-time, and I worked for a number of different organisations. I did some work with the Scottish Government. There was a really interesting opportunity for me to bring skills that I had learned and taken for granted working in retailing and apply them to the census in the Scottish Government. So I worked with them as a project manager to help deliver the census, whereby everybody in the country was counted and asked demographic information, which is this kind of huge project and unusual in terms of the type of activity, the type of people that have to be recruited. So I was working, I was doing my degree at the same time. And what was really interesting is that as part of that period of study and studying art history, one of the things that you would study is institutional critique. You would look at art galleries, museums, their roles as institutions, how they are managed, how the way that they are managed influences the culture that is inside them, how that culture influences society. And I became really interested in the extent to which I had spent 12 years of my life working for a big institution, a multinational retailer, that worked internationally and functioned in a way that affected culture, because it was fashion. It was what people were wearing. And I saw such synergies between that and a museum. And I looked at the two and I thought, this is really interesting. These are both institutions. They're both institutions that shape culture. But what I was really fascinated by was the extent to which they were managed very differently, that they were seen to be so far apart that the way you would manage them would be different. And so this then led me to make this connection whereby I started to go, okay, what's the connection between management and these types of cultural organizations? And from there, I went on to do a postgraduate master's program in arts management. And then out of that, there was an opportunity then to undertake some teaching work. And I then did a PhD part-time alongside undertaking teaching activity. And so that's kind of how I ended up back in universities.
And somehow back and also in the deep end, because also with your more recent and even current positions as dean and project leader, you've taken sort of many different experiences, as you've very sort of really concisely taken us through a number of years and developments in your life and in your career. To get you to a place, and I think this is also what is what I'm thinking at the back of my mind, when you said sort of seeing the impact, when that was one of the sort of satisfying points of being in the retail business. And it reminds you of other colleagues, not only in academia, but I was thinking about the ones in academia who sometimes do not get that satisfaction because maybe it's a lot of research which is intended to inform policy, but then somehow things fizzle out. Or politics change, or the funding doesn't materialize. So somehow, I guess your sort of trajectory allowed the impacts that which has also in the last few years become such a big word in the field of cultural policy and other social science areas to be quite real, because you were sort of seeing the dynamics between all these different institutions.
And I think the other thing as well, and I am forever grateful that, you know, as you say, I've kind of come back into the space and I found myself as, you know, running a department and in my current role now being a dean of school. And what I love is the fact that nothing that I've done in the past has been, you know, is not serving me now. Everything that I've done in the past, I can draw from in some way. And yeah, that insight that I gained from working in that kind of commercial retailing space. Because for me, and methodologically, I'm interested in discourse and words and language and the way in which it can shape and kind of limit the way we look at the world. And so for me, I like to look at patterns and things that are similar in terms of our social practices. And what fascinates me is the fact that in different professional fields, you might call them different things or you might see it in different ways. And so when you talk about impact now, you know, it's assumed to be something that's, you know, positive for, you know, social impact or economic impact. But fundamentally, impact is the force of one activity, one object, one entity against another, and that there is some interconnection between the two. And in a retailing position, yes, you looked at the whole year, you looked at how much income you generated, whether the shop ran or generated more money than last year. But you also looked at impact on a very day-to-day basis. And so you were excited if, you know, today you sold 20 more pairs of jeans than you did yesterday. You also looked at the impact on customers. And so we used to spend an awful lot of time talking about ensuring that people had a good experience and that the staff that were in the shops had a good experience. And so impact was both very, very small and very, very big. And you would zoom out and you would zoom in. And that was just part of the conversation. We didn't tie ourselves up in knots going, are we having impact? You just assumed that, of course, you had impact. And you talked about it and you observed it and you spoke about it.
And you could see it.
And you saw it. It was everywhere around you. And I think I take the same approach now in academia, is that we're having impact all the time. Everything has impact. The question is, you know, what type of impact? Do we understand how that impact happened? If we wanted to recreate it, could we? But having an impact on, say, a policymaker where I have a conversation and maybe they take away one thing from it. that's an impact. And if that means that in 4 weeks' time or a month's time, when they're at a different meeting, they maybe think of that discussion mm-hmm. that we had, and maybe that changes a bit of wording, and maybe that means that over time they start to influence something. It's those are all impacts, mm-hmm. and they create a chain of impact that builds yes. over time. Yes. And you see that start to develop. And it's, to me, it's the same thing, in retailing. And I'm sure a lot of my academic colleagues, if there are any listening to this, will be mortified at the fact that I'm trying to compare academia to selling clothes. But for me, there's no value judgment between mm-hmm. those two mm-hmm. things. They're social activities, and those social activities can mm-hmm. be seen in the same ways. And so for me, you were always taught, you got a new customer. If that new customer came in and maybe only spent £5, they bought a pair of socks.
Mm-hmm.
If they had a good experience, if you had a positive interaction with them, an impact on their life, if they went away feeling good about themselves and feeling that you cared, they might tell somebody else. They might come mm-hmm. back.
They might come back, exactly.
They may have a family. That family yeah. may over time then come back and shop, and they may become loyal. And then over time, before you know it, you have that one person that bought those socks mm-hmm. has actually generated a whole raft of different customers. Yes. And it's the same thing with impact, is that what is so exciting for me, so what I love about the job is when you see either students that you've taught or a policymaker that you've influenced and you bump into them 5 years later or 7 years later or 8 years later, and they don't remember everything you've ever said to them or everything you've ever taught to them. But there are some things that may have stuck with them, and that starts to percolate into what they do. And so those tiny impacts, that impact that you had on a student in a classroom or at a meeting, that was an impact, and that impact will build over time. And it is so exciting when I see yes. now students that I was teaching 8 or 9 years ago entering into senior positions in the arts sector and implementing things that have clearly come out of discussions that we mm-hmm. had 8 years ago. And
somehow
it's
you that see that build up.
Yeah.
I think at the beginning you said something like things might not always work out immediately, and it takes yeah. time sometimes for them to pan out. And I think even maybe teachers and other people listening to us will relate to that. Even students will sort of say, yes, after a certain amount of time, maybe some things came together. With regards to time, David, we're really nearing already the last minute of our conversation. So time is really flying by in our case. But there's still one more track I'd like you to tell us a little bit about, the second track you've chosen on this program of In Campus Ali Hall today. And then come back for the last few minutes of our conversation. So what's the second track about?
Okay, so yeah, the second track, a bit more unusual. I've slipped in a film by the back door by having a track from a film. My second track is I Will Follow Him, sung by Whoopi Goldberg and the cast of Sister Act. And the reason I picked this again is twofold. As I said, my musical tastes are varied and are driven by memories. And basically my fiance, he loves this song. He loves this movie and genuinely loves it. And would watch it over and over again and is simply joyful every time he hears this particular song. And what excites me about it is that I knew it, I've seen the film, but his memory, his passion for it, his love of it now connects me to it. And so when I hear it, it reminds me of him. Mm. It reminds me of the joy that it brings him. Mm. And that has a feedback loop that then feeds into my own kind of joy for it. So it makes me smile because it is both a joyful thing, but also because I know that it brings joy to someone who I love.
Very good. Let's listen to it then. I think my guest today, David Stevenson on Campus Alihor, hit another nail on the head there with that music and the connection. Because again, it means stuff to you, to your partner, to you together, but I'm sure even our listeners have their own memories and connections. So David, as I said, we're nearing the final part. We've got a bit less than 10 minutes left. And there is one area of your research, which again, with hindsight, in a program like this, in a short conversation like this, that one might tend to see as the natural next step, which is your recent and even current research together with colleagues and in terms of projects, publications, on the theme of failure and arts organization, arts institutions, and even cultural setups. I wonder whether, in a way, yes, one could argue that somehow failure is it's an underlying theme in all of our lives, and it's part of our human experience. But then on the one hand, sometimes we get that sort of bravado narrative of failing to succeed, and we stop there. Whereas your approach is much more nuanced than that. Sort of it's something which accompanies us. It's not something you just overcome in order to succeed and put a full stop on. Is that a fair, quick, rough assessment from my end? And what else could you tell us a little bit why this topic has fascinated you?
Yeah, I fully agree with the way you've described it. And the reason it fascinates me is because my work in the past has looked at things about cultural participation, about social inclusion, about the extent to which the arts wants to be a sector that invites all and feels welcoming to all. And that is an incredible and very good aspiration that I think we can all sign up to. But what I was interested in is that even within my academic career, I was having the same conversations a decade later that I was having a decade previously with organizations saying, gosh, you know, we don't have enough diversity, or, you know, isn't it difficult that we don't attract certain people? And what I was really struck with was the word failure never came up. Nobody ever mentioned it. It was never present. It was never spoken about in the discourse. And so from there, I started to really think about why is that not mentioned? Because as you said, I think personally, I mean, I fail all the time. It's part and parcel of any day or week. Is that you think, oh, I'm going to do this, and I failed to do it. You know, I failed to go to the gym today. I failed to pick up something at the post office that I meant to do. And yet, within policy, the idea of failing has become so massive in people's minds, because there's a sense that if a politician fails, they must be torn down. It's the end of the journey. That there's this sense that, as you say, failure is a full stop. You either succeed or you fail. And actually, the world is more complex than that. We know that as academics. And it is this process, and this process that will have success and failure sitting side by side. And if we want to achieve really difficult things, challenging things like social inclusion, like equality, like equity, then there are going to be many, many failures in trying to deliver that in the arts sector. And so that's what the research really is interested in exploring, is saying, this is complex. Why would we not expect to have failures? And we need to be able to talk about those failures and to say, how do we adapt and respond to them? And again, there is literature on failure within very much the business sector, which sees it in a very entrepreneurial sense, the notion of fast failure. And fast failure was a big area of work that kind of was developed throughout the 1990s. You know, fail quickly, learn from it, adapt, respond, move forward. And my concern is that if you don't recognize failures when they're happening, the opportunity to adapt and respond and move forward doesn't occur, or is dragged out over a very, very long period. And what the research has found, particularly in the UK cultural sector, is that people are really afraid of saying that something has failed. They're afraid that they'll lose funding. They're afraid that they'll be judged. They'll be judged by their peers, other artists, other cultural workers, that they'll be judged by the public. And what that breeds is one, not taking risks, and two, repeating things that we know don't work. So running outreach projects, running projects that we know are good, they're valuable in and of themselves, but they aren't delivering what we're looking for. And obviously, when it comes to policy, we want to achieve certain ends. And for me, my concern is that the debate about the value of culture has got caught up with this sense around about delivering policy aims. Something can be valuable whilst failing to have delivered on its policy outcomes. And those two things are separate. It can be valuable for many reasons, but it hasn't delivered what we wanted to. If, for example, I went out for you with for dinner and you made me a beautiful dinner with the finest seafood that was available, that would be really valuable. It was valuable because it's food and it's got energy and we would have a nice time. It would have been a failure, though, because I'm a vegetarian. Now, so in terms of providing me with dinner, it would have failed. But it's still valuable. That doesn't mean that it's not a valuable thing in and of itself. And that, for me, is where the discourse and cultural policy has become too knotted, in that the value and the success or failure in delivering really important aims are conflated. And so we worry about saying that something has failed because we think that saying it's failed is also saying it's not valuable.
There's a vacuum in the value. In fact, what you're talking about, I'm thinking of sort of, it is the opposite possible as well, of having sort of success, but its value being maybe diminished, worn down, overused, because you keep sort of doing what's been done and having a level of success, but not really exploring the value that might lie in it. David, we're in the last couple of minutes. I wonder whether you could tell us whether this is something you think you'll keep exploring, or you're already seeing maybe a mutation of it within your research, within that of colleagues, within that of students, within the sector in general.
I think yes, I will probably continue. I think what's always interesting as a researcher is you start something and you keep going at it for a while and nobody's paying any attention to it. And then by the time people start paying attention to it, you've been looking at it for such a long time that you're like, oh my God, I want to leave this behind.
And you're moving on.
Everyone wants to now start talking about it because you're like, oh no. And yeah, what we've been really struck by, myself and my colleague at Leeds University, Leila, that I've been doing this work with, is that we've had a lot of interest from people working outside of the art sector who have been really struck with the framework we've put together. So people working in education, people working in community development, people working in the health sector. And so saying, we recognize these patterns. We recognize that we've fallen into this trap of not being able to recognize failure. And so I think there may be scope that potentially what may move on from this. And at the moment, we're working on a book that will kind of summarize the project we've been doing for the last 3 years. But once that's done, the next stage for us is to think about whether this approach, whether our framework, the fail space framework, can be taken into other sectors and potentially used by other people.
Yes, because I guess there's the element also of influence. You talk a lot about of how different areas of your experience in life have influenced each other. And it's not one way, but there's a sort of not only mutuality, but even more than that, because there's sort of this, I think before you used the word like percolation, how influences percolate over time, and somehow then leave a form of sediment, which we can keep learning from.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the unexpected turns up where, and I think again, one of the gifts that I've had from doing lots of different things is that I'm able to speak to different people in different audiences and recognize that there are different worlds. Those worlds have very similar experiences. They might call them different things. They might label them different things. But if you step back from the language and you look at what are the experiences that we're having, then you're able to say, yeah, actually, this is similar. And being able to step into those different spaces without feeling too nervous, and with having the confidence to go, I recognize this. I don't know what you call it. I don't know necessarily how you speak about it in your professional sector, but this is definitely something that I recognize from my worlds and the worlds that I've been involved in, is exciting. And it's exciting to work with new people and to enter new areas and to risk failure to risk that it might not work. And if it doesn't work and if it fails, reflect on why that was and do something else, because that failure is also now part of that percolation of things coming together And before you know it, something else beautiful emerges.
Mm-hmm. David, there's so much more I'd like to talk with you about, and I'm sure our listeners will have many questions they would like to get answered from your end. But I'm afraid the time's up. However, I do refer our listeners to your research projects, available online, papers, forthcoming publications as well. Because yes, as you said, there's sort of this very, rolling adventure. And the more one is open and curious and able to connect, then the more experiences one gets. And thank you very much for taking the time to share a small amount, a small angle, a narrow angle onto this very, very exciting world, which is sort of cultural policy, arts management, and everything that goes into it. So thank you very much again, David.
And not at all. My pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Smajn l-intervista l-David Stevenson ta' Queen Margaret University ġewwa l-Università tal-Iskozja ta' Edinburgh. Nittama li oġbitkom kien hemm numru ta' elementi vari ki simpatiċi f'dik l-intervista u nistedinkom tingħaqdu miegħi għal programmi ieħor li jmiss fis-sensiela minn kampus għal ieħor il-ġumgħa d-dieħla. Saħħit.